Today is Monday, the 2nd of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A top U.S. infectious disease expert says the country won't lock down again, even though COVID-19 cases are surging.
It's going up. How far up it goes is going to depend on how we as a society address it.
Plus, the Taliban attacks an Afghan airport runway.
It appears that the Taliban are trying to stretch to the maximum the abilities.
We'll have these stories and more next. On Sunday, the top U.S. infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said that the United States will not lock down again to curb COVID-19. He noted that things are going to get worse as the Delta variant fuels a surge in cases, mostly among the unvaccinated. Reuters' Chris Dignam starts us off.
And the data.
President Joe Biden's chief medical advisor, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said on ABC's This Week, follow a recent interview with Reuters during which the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases said he did not see there being a nationwide vaccine mandate either, but hoped that full FDA approval for COVID-19 vaccines would come this month,
the middle of August,
and spur more Americans to get shots to slow a rising infection rate.
It's going up. How far up it goes is going to depend on how we as a society address it. The more people you get vaccinated, the less likely it's going to go up even more.
Although Fauci did not think the U.S. will need to shut down again as it did last year, he warned on ABC that, quote, things are going to get worse as the Delta variant continues to spread. According to a Reuters analysis, the average number of new U.S. cases reported each day has nearly doubled in the past 10 days, and the number of hospitalized patients in many states is surging. Florida has one of the worst outbreaks in the nation based on new cases per capita. It has reported more than 110,000 new cases in the past week, a 50% increase from the week prior.
Chris Dignam of Reuters News. After a slow start, the European Union has now overtaken the United States in vaccinating its citizens against COVID-19. Anti-vaccine resistance remains, including in France, where officials estimate more than 200,000 people joined demonstrations this past weekend to protest against a mandatory health pass. Lisa Bryant is up next.
Brandishing banners proclaiming freedom and passive shame, tens of thousands of people demonstrated in Paris and other French cities Saturday against government measures to fight the coronavirus pandemic and the disease it causes, COVID-19. While many of the protests were peaceful, several police officers were wounded trying to keep order in Paris. In the southern city of Marseille, demonstrators destroyed a coronavirus testing tent, shouting assassins and collaborators. The demonstrations marked the third straight weekend of protests and were the biggest so far. Some protesters have worn yellow stars of David, similar to those Jews were forced to wear in former Nazi Germany, a move slammed by Holocaust survivors. The protesters included members of the far left and far right, and those representing the Yellow Vest Economic Justice Movement, born a few years ago.
Je suis venu exprimer un ras-le-bol général de la population française.
We're protesting the government system that's been in place for decades, one protester told French radio, calling new coronavirus measures another example of bad government. The new policies aim to fight the sharply rising tide of infections driven by the highly contagious Delta variant. Among them, making COVID vaccines mandatory for health workers and requiring health passes showing people have been vaccinated or tested negative for the infection to gain access to restaurants, movie theaters, trains, and tourist venues. President Emmanuel Macron has said he respects the right to protest, but that vaccinations are an essential arm to fight the coronavirus, and that French also have responsibilities along with rights and civic duties. Unvaccinated people now comprise about 85% of hospitalizations in France and 78% of COVID-19-linked deaths. But some here are still skeptical or worried about the shot. While supporting the new health pass, conservative lawmaker Philippe Bas told French Radio Sunday the government must strengthen public confidence. Like France, Italy has also seen protests against vaccines and other measures to curb the pandemic. The public response, however, has been more positive elsewhere in Europe, including in Denmark and Spain. And despite demonstrations here, polls show the majority of French back the health pass. More than half are now fully vaccinated. President Macron, who faces re-election next year, has also seen his approval rating rise in recent months over his handling of the pandemic. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Australia's east coast states of New South Wales and Queensland faced an escalating battle against the COVID-19 Delta variant Sunday, with millions under strict lockdown and authorities urging more testing and vaccinations to rein in the outbreaks. Reuters' Jason Albano has that story.
Australia's COVID-19 battle in the states of New South Wales and Queensland worsened on Sunday. That's despite millions being kept under strict lockdown for 5 weeks in its largest city, Sydney. The country on Sunday reported 239 new cases of the highly infectious Delta variant, matching the record set on Thursday. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian urged residents once again to get vaccinated.
Today is the 1st of August and I'm calling upon the people of Greater Sydney, of Greater New South Wales to come forward and get vaccinated. To get to the 70% target, we need 9.2 million jabs. To get to the 80% target, we need 10 million jabs. And we've been talking about this in New South Wales for some time.
Australia's vaccination drive has been sluggish, with only 18% of adults fully vaccinated so far. That's owing to a vaccine supply shortage and changing medical advice. The current outbreak, which began in June, has seen cases climb to more than 3,400. Sydney's 5 million residents are now expected to remain under lockdown until at least August 28.
Reuters reporter Jason Albano. In the South Asia region that has been devastated by the COVID-19 pandemic, the tiny mountain kingdom of Bhutan stands out as a rare success story. Has reported two deaths and about 2,500 cases and vaccinated 90% of its adult population. As Anjana Pasricha reports, even though Bhutan has a small population, health experts say the country has emerged ahead of many nations despite its limited resources.
These helping hands come from Bhutan's so-called orange workforce. They belong to some of about 30,000 citizen volunteers helping script a rare COVID-19 pandemic success story in the Himalayan country. When the coronavirus hit, authorities offered financial incentives to people to assist its small pool of health personnel and called for volunteers.
And within a very short period of time, the volunteer system got crashed because there were so many people wanting to volunteer. And it was an amazing sort of an experience, you know, to see that here you have incentives, but instead of the incentives, people were actually registering to volunteer, wanting to give something back to the community.
The country of about 750,000 people has now fully vaccinated 90% of adults in an effort propelled by international donors, its leaders, and the community. The first 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca vaccine came from India. After New Delhi halted exports, Bhutan turned to donors. In July, the COVAX initiative sent Moderna vaccines. Administering two different vaccines was never an issue in a country with implicit faith in its constitutional monarch, King Jigme Khesar Namgyel Wangchuk. Neither was vaccine hesitancy.
As a frontliner, I think it's my responsibility to be vaccinated. And also because His Majesty has done so much for us, so we feel it is our responsibility as a citizen.
So people do understand the benefit of vaccine. People do understand that the vaccine does prevent diseases, and they have seen it for generations.
The second doses were administered in just a week, even reaching far-flung mountain areas. UNICEF called it the fastest vaccination campaign during the pandemic.
If Bhutan can succeed in a monsoon with so few health workers to get the entire population that's eligible, almost the entire population eligible, vaccinated, and then move to the children, maybe Bhutan can be a beacon of hope in a region that is on fire.
Bhutan's king has trekked to remote hamlets to rally people, especially after the transmissible Delta variant began ravaging India, with which Bhutan has a porous border.
I think if there's lessons to be learned out of Bhutan, it is, of course, the compassionate leadership that has to come from the top. And by compassionate leadership, I mean having deep empathy, really walking in the shoes of others, and then actively making efforts to support people throughout this terrible, terrible pandemic.
Bhutan's success is being attributed to coming together as a nation in a crisis. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Officials in southern Afghanistan confirmed on Sunday that an overnight rocket attack by Taliban insurgents damaged the runway at Kandahar Airport, forcing the suspension of all flights. From Islamabad, Pakistan, Ayaz Gul joins us for this update.
Yeah, this was quite a significant blow to the operations that Afghan security forces have been conducting in southern Afghanistan against the Taliban. And because this is the airport that was being used to fly combat aircraft, they were basically targeting Taliban positions. Now, with this airport now almost dysfunctional, at least for a couple of days, obviously it has given the Taliban an upper hand. And what we have seen today after that attack, that Taliban were able to conduct a sort of guerrilla attacks against Afghan security forces in and around the Kandahar city, which is the second largest city of Afghanistan. And at the same time, in the neighboring Lashkargah city, which is the capital of Helmand province, inside the city, a lot of fighting was going on since yesterday. And today we saw that Taliban still continued attacking Afghan security forces positions inside the city. So it's that attack was quite a significant blow to the government forces. And that's why we saw that there was no let up in fighting all day today.
So, Ayaz, what is the larger impact of the runways being closed at Kandahar Airport? You mentioned that Afghan forces were using it as a staging ground to conduct airstrikes against Taliban forces. But with the airport more or less out of action for the immediate future, what are you seeing and hearing from your contacts as the likely impact that will have on fighting in the region?
Well, we obviously, as you know, the Afghan Air Force has been, playing a key role in helping the security forces on the ground to contain Taliban advances. We still saw that there were flights, there were fighter jets taking off from elsewhere in the country and going and targeting Taliban positions there. But, you know, for how long the Afghan Air Force can sustain this kind of a pressure, you know, continuous involvement in the fighting against the Taliban and attacking them is also a big question. There's a big question mark because we know that for years, the Afghan Air Force was heavily relying on U.S. military air power. Their advisors and their support, their contractors were actually helping the Afghan government sustain their air force. Now, with this limited facility being extensively used, Taliban are now targeting these key facilities like the Kandahar Airport, obviously it's going to put more pressure on the Afghan security forces. And we saw today that there were intense clashes even in the western Herat province and in the capital of that province. And even Taliban were able to enter the city and there were intense clashes going on. And the Afghan Air Force was called in to conduct airstrikes there. It appears that the Taliban are trying to stretch to the maximum the abilities of the Afghan security forces and air force by engaging them on so many fronts, that it's going to create a lot of challenges in coming days if the fight continues like the way we have seen over the last 2 days.
Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad. Myanmar's military ruler, Min Aung Hlaing, on Sunday again promised new multi-party elections and said that his government is ready to work with any special envoy named by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN. From Reuters News, Brian Wood has the details.
Myanmar's military ruler, Min Aung Hlaing, promised to hold multi-party elections but did not say when exactly that would happen.
I would like to say that Myanmar is ready to work on ASEAN cooperation within the ASEAN framework, including the dialogue with the ASEAN Special Envoy in Myanmar.
In February, Myanmar's army seized power from a civilian government led by Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi after her ruling party won in disputed elections. The military called the vote fraudulent and branded members of Suu Kyi's party extremists, but the country's electoral commission dismissed the allegation. Military authorities have faced near daily protests since the coup and a resurgence of armed conflicts in the borderlands. One local activist group estimated that armed forces have so far killed more than 900 people, with nearly 7,000 military opponents arrested. ASEAN foreign ministers will meet on Monday as diplomats aim to appoint a special envoy tasked with promoting dialogue between Myanmar's junta and its opponents.
Reuters' Brian Wood. A United Nations overview of conditions in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province after more than 9 months of civil strife finds a society of staggering devastation, of ruined lives and livelihoods. Lisa Schlein reports.
Thousands of people have been killed and 2 million internally displaced since Ethiopian troops invaded Tigray on November 4th to retake the province from rebel forces. The United Nations reports millions of people are suffering from acute hunger, with some 400,000 on the verge of famine. Malnutrition is soaring, putting thousands of children's lives at risk. Spokesman for the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Lajerke, says 5.2 million people, around 90% of the population, are now dependent on humanitarian aid for survival.
There's extremely limited time left to halt the rapid deterioration of the food security situation. Trucks should be arriving into Mekelle every day. Aid organizations estimate that at least 500 trucks of supplies are needed each week to meet the needs of people in Tigray. That's not happening.
Lajerke notes only one truck convoy of aid supplies has been able to enter Tigray since late June. Newly appointed UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffith is halfway through a six-day mission to Ethiopia. He's expected to travel to Tigray to assess the humanitarian situation for himself. Observers say he will find a desolate landscape full of traumatized people. Lajerke says civilians have been victims of multiple atrocities and abuse by the warring parties.
Horrific violations against civilians have been reported throughout the conflict. This includes the widespread and systematic use of rape as a tactic of war, and more than 1,600 cases of sexual and gender-based violence has been reported since the conflict began. Health facilities have been targeted, attacked, and looted. Only 16 out of 40 hospitals in Tigray are fully functioning. Women and girls who have survived sexual violence have few, if any, place to go for medical help.
Lajerke says UN and private agencies are operating within an extremely dangerous environment. He notes at least 12 aid workers have been killed in Tigray. This includes the brutal murder of three staff from the charity Doctors Without Borders on June 24th. The OCHA spokesman says money also is a problem. He says UN agencies require more than $430 million to implement their life-saving operations through the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United States military has confirmed carrying out a third airstrike against al-Shabaab militants in less than 2 weeks. The U.S. military says Sunday's strike was in support of Somali government forces in the vicinity of Kaykod in the central Galmudug state. The Somali government earlier reported the strike in an area where federal and U.S. trained forces were fighting al-Shabaab militants. No civilian casualties have been reported. An overcrowded wooden boat carrying hundreds of migrants was spotted in the Mediterranean overnight on Sunday. At least 394 migrants were rescued by German and French NGO ships Sea-Watch 3 and Ocean Viking in Tunisian waters in an operation that lasted 6 hours, according to a Reuters witness. It is not clear if there were any deaths or injuries among the migrants, who were mainly men from Morocco, Bangladesh, Egypt, and Syria. Reuters reports Belarusian Olympic sprinter Kristina Tsimonoskaya refused to board a flight leaving Tokyo and sought protection from authorities. The sprinter said that she had been taken to the airport against her wishes after complaining about the national team coaching staff at the Olympic Games. Tsimonoskaya was seen with police at Haneda Airport and told a Reuters photographer that she felt safe. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett blamed Iran for an attack on an oil tanker off the coast of Oman that killed two people. Tehran denied being involved with the assault that took place last Thursday. No one claimed responsibility for the attack, though Iran has previously conducted similar attacks.
This is Science in a Minute.
I recently told you about the undocking of a 20-year-old Russian module at the International Space Station. After undocking, the module, named Piers, was sent back to Earth, and most of it was destroyed by its blazing trip through the atmosphere. The space at the ISS, left open by Piers, was filled by Russia's new Nauka multipurpose laboratory module on Thursday, July 29th at 1329 UTC. After docking, the Russian space agency Roscosmos said telemetry information and reports by the ISS crew indicated that the module is operating normally. However, several hours after docking, NASA reported an unplanned firing of the module's thrusters, which caused the ISS to move out of alignment. NASA says ground teams recovered the space station's attitude and motion and is stable. They also say the crew was and is not in any danger. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Thousands of Turkish firefighters are battling for a fifth day against raging fires that are threatening some of Turkey's main tourist resorts. Dorian Jones reports that at least six people have already died because of the fires.
A child cries, fire, fire, as a family drives through the night trying to escape the surrounding inferno in Turkey's Marmaris region. The video has gone viral in Turkey. Firefighters, backed by helicopters, are battling raging fires across Turkey's Mediterranean and Aegean regions, home to some of Europe's most prominent tourist resorts. Record high temperatures and powerful dry winds are hampering their efforts. Authorities have issued evacuation orders for tourists in some resorts. One of the worst affected areas is Turkey's Bodrum resort. Bodrum resident Melis Bieder spoke to VOA Sunday.
Yeah, I feel terrible, Yani. We are under stress, of course, because it's very hot here. One that started in Mumcular, which is on the airport road in Bodrum, is still spreading. The others have been put down. And as the wind is picking up again, it's getting more dangerous again. Some people are very stressed, very sad. On the other hand, I was hearing party music from the shore last night.
The fires are dealing a hammer blow to Turkey's vital tourism industry, still trying to recover from losses caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Many farmers, too, have been devastated by the fires. This farmer, who didn't want to be identified, in Turkey's Manavgat region, is traumatized by the experience. He says, I don't care if it's a car or house burned, but look at these animals. They lost their lives. They are my life. These were my beauties. These were my hope. He adds, but a calf was born in all this chaos. I took it from the fire. My children wrapped it in their arms. But its mother died. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Saturday, in a 30-vehicle convoy, visited some of the worst-hit resorts. He declared the region a disaster zone, promising compensation for those who have suffered losses. Authorities are investigating whether some of the more than 100 fires could be arson, and Erdogan gave a chilling warning to any perpetrator.
Ciğerimizi yakanın ciğerini sökmek boynumuzun borcudur.
He says, if you rip our heart out, I swear we will rip your heart out. If we find such a connection, there are already some indications. We will do whatever it takes. The government is facing growing criticism that the country's fleet of firefighting planes are out of action, relying instead on three rented Russian planes. Erdogan said that more planes had arrived and more were on the way from neighboring Ukraine, Russia and Azerbaijan. Authorities say that most of the more than 100 fires are under control, but some resorts remain under threat. And with temperatures forecast to soar to new record levels in the coming days, the fight appears far from over. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Wildfires continue to burn throughout parts of the American West, with officials reporting at least 7 new ones over the weekend. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Oregon's Bootleg Fire, the largest in the country at over 413,000 acres, it destroyed 400 structures. But spokesperson Al Nash said over the weekend, containment went from 53% to 74%.
It represents a pretty significant jump in the amount of containment that we have on this fire. And so we feel really good.
California's Dixie Fire, the largest in the state at more than 244,000 acres, is 32% contained. Cal Fire's Rick Carhart.
There's a better chance that an evacuation order or warning is going to be either lowered or lifted.
According to federal authorities, 91 active fires are burning in western states. I'm Julie Walker.
And finally, New Zealand has formally apologized to the Pacific community, which felt terrorized during police raids searching for visa overstayers during the 1970s. The so-called Dawn Raids, which were carried out between 1974 and 1976, targeted only people from the Pacific Islands, even though statistics showed that the vast majority of overstayers were from Europe and the United States. Phil Mercer takes it from here.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the immigration raids were dehumanizing. Speaking at Auckland Town Hall, she expressed her government's sorrow and remorse. She acknowledged the distress and hurt the raids had caused. Many Pacific Islanders moved to New Zealand after World War II to boost a workforce ravaged by conflict overseas. By 1976, they made up just over 2% of the population, or about 65,000 people, according to the national census. As the economy faltered, though, Samoans, Tongans and other Pacific Islanders, who'd arrived as desperately needed migrant workers, were suddenly accused of taking jobs away from New Zealanders. That prompted a crackdown by the police on those suspected of overstaying their visas. Churches, schools and workplaces were routinely raided, as were homes, often in the middle of the night. New Zealand's Minister for Pacific Peoples, Aupito Williams-Seo, recalled when his family was targeted.
To have somebody knocking at the door in the early hours of the morning with a flashlight in your face, disrespecting the owner of the home, with an Alsatian dog frothing at the mouth in that door and wanting to come in without any respect for the people living in there, is quite traumatized. I have sisters said, oh my goodness, I never even want to think about that. That's just my family. That's replicated across the Pacific community.
Thousands of people were arrested and deported, and many have recalled their humiliation and pain. Both major political parties in New Zealand have accepted that the raids were racist. British and American visitors, who made up about 40% of overstayers at the time, were rarely targeted by the authorities. New Zealand governments rarely make formal apologies for past injustices. Ardern also announced that education scholarships would be provided to Pacific communities in New Zealand, including those from Samoa, the Cook Islands, Fiji, and Kiribati. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.